Welcome to Mysterious Universe, Season 29, Episode 17. Coming up on this show, we've got past life excursions, battling death in the pool of the afterlife, and Bigfoot's cute, hairy ass. I'm Benjamin Grundy. Joining me is Aaron Wright.
I mean, I would probably ask you about the first two headlines, but since I'm covering those stories, I know what's going on. Why are we talking about Bigfoot's cute, hairy ass?
Do you remember about 15 years ago, maybe more than that, 16 years ago, Paul Cropper and Tony Healy released that wonderful Australian book.
Yeah, they're on the show.
The Yowie. Yeah, we interviewed them on the show and they had this incredible work, which was 300 documented reports of Yowie sightings in Australia going all the way back to the colonial period. Tons of great sightings in there.
Yeah, I recall the book was excellent.
It's the best resource on Australian Yowie sightings. If you're unfamiliar, the Yowie is like our Bigfoot.
It's Bigfoot, yeah.
Big, hairy, stinky.
Making baby noises in the forest.
Idiotic.
Will
bumbling,
try to.
Peanut butter loving.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Very
knock on your house.
Sexy-assed giant okay, humanoid.
Stop. Okay, again, I'm going to pull you up there. I've never heard Bigfoot having a sexy ass before. Where is this coming from?
All right, so this is the new one. This is the Yowie file from, again, Paul Cropper and Tony Healy. This is their follow-up.
Has it been approved by Netflix? Is that why it's got a cute hairy ass?
Yeah, they changed the race of the Bigfoot. He went from orange hair to black hair in this one. No, it's a follow-up with brand new reports. They've gone back to the colonial era. They've found even more reports from, you know, very early, like the 1700s.
Really?
Early 1800s. Just incredible stuff. And they've teamed up in a way with Dean Harrison from the AYR, the Australian Yowie Research Organisation.
He's got a great YouTube channel, which I haven't been to admittedly in a while, but his stuff is great because he talks to people that claim that they have their experiences. And what's really fascinating about the reports that he covers is that it's like truck drivers and campers, you know, very contemporary reports of people going out into the Australian bush and encountering these things. Like, they're down-to-earth people, just normal people, and they're having these crazy encounters.
Well, if you remember, Dean launched the website after he was attacked by one of these things. One of these hairy...
I recall that.
...hairy creatures. He had an encounter with it in the bush. He was with others, but alone at the time, and it basically charged him and plowed into him with its forearm and started to attack him.
I seem to recall that he had like a photograph of all these bruises down his leg as well.
Well, he was trying to fight it off. He thought he was going to be killed by this thing, and he was screaming out to his other, you know, campers, and they came to his aid, and the thing, you know, rushed off into the bush. But he said something to the effect of, if I didn't have other people with me, I would have become another missing person statistic.
Why would he think that? Just because it was such a horrible experience.
He thought it was going to kill him.
Yeah.
It was going to kill him. And they've teamed up with his outfit for many of these contemporary accounts, because when he launched the site, he was shocked. So many people came forward because they finally had an avenue to share the stories they'd been sitting on, the encounters they had had, you know, going back to the 70s and 80s and onwards. So we've got brand new reports that weren't covered in the first volume. There's nearly 300 new reports in addition to the 300 we had from the first book. And there's a trend.
Which is the hairy, cute ass.
The Bigfoot, sexy, hairy ass.
So why? Why? Because he just points his ass at witnesses?
There's these cases, and this only happens one way. It's always a male Yowie appears to display himself to female witnesses. And there's multiple cases where he's doing like a Schwarzenegger Mr. Universe pose on some outcrop. And the eyewitnesses are like, he had the most incredible ass I've ever seen. And they're very visceral in the way they describe, like the rippling muscles. I could see it. His abs were shining through.
What the hell is going on?
His calves were rippling in this musculature. And
he's not the same species.
And what an ass. Yeah, but the figure, it's like, I guess if I saw a hairy woman, if she had a nice figure, I could say, yeah, she had a nice figure. That's essentially
what... had a few drinks on board, well...
But there's none of these scenarios where it's like a female Sasquatch, you know, with her tits out and like leaning back like a French pose or anything. There's nothing like that. It's always a male Yowie displaying himself to these female eyewitnesses.
I'm sure we'll get into it, but I do have to ask the question, what's changed? Because we know of all these reports in the past. Like we're quite, you know, across these reports. I've never heard of this. I mean, yes, it's been described as having, you know, large voluminous bulk. You know, that's one of the terms that's been used. But where did this kind of weird, kind of sexy angle kind of come in? Did he change his tact? Is that what Bigfoot's doing now?
I think it's just an Australian thing. I think it is. And the Aboriginals have stories of, and I'll mention one of these later on in the segment.
Of sexy Bigfoot.
Not sexy Bigfoot, but sexy Bigfoot stealing their women, running off with their women.
Yeah, that's been there for a long time. Yeah, the Indigenous Australians have always described that, yeah, it's like he will steal, or they will steal.
That's in Native American folklore as well.
Yeah, that's true.
North American Sasquatch and in Russia as well, I think. So it's just amazing to see all these reports compiled together, and I'm going to share some of my picks for you because there's so many in here, obviously, including the most giant offensive turd ever seen, and DNA tested as well.
But you can't just get DNA out of poop.
Oh, you can't?
No.
There's this funny section at the end where they're like, we sent this to a university and they said they couldn't get any DNA, but it's a cover-up. It's a cover-up. But now you're just saying you can't get DNA from...
There's a possibility. You can't rule out the possibility that maybe there's the, you know, stray endothelial cell that might come through. But for the most part, it's next to impossible to get DNA out of poo, unless the technology's changed.
What if it's like a foot long? Does that change the scenario?
I can't believe what we're going to get into. I'm a little bit scared, to be honest. Okay, well, I'm looking forward to getting into that later on in the show. But to start off this show, on our last Plus episode, I was talking about the incredible story of Gwen McDonald. And Gwen McDonald is this woman who was under the care of hypnotherapist Peter Ramster. And Peter Ramster is kind of like a really intriguing figure in the field of reincarnation and past life experiences. And the reason why he stands out is because in the case of Gwen McDonald, and there was this great documentary that he put together in 1981, just simply called Reincarnation. And with this particular documentary, he took Gwen, but also three other Australian women, and these women had spontaneous recall of past life experiences. And with a lot of past life experiences, yeah, it's fascinating to hear the details. And then sometimes you can go and try and verify some of the information by looking up archive records. But back in the 1980s, that was obviously a lot harder. He took these women to the locations that they recalled while under trance. Mm. And Gwen was this outstanding case because she hadn't been anywhere. She'd never been anywhere outside of Australia. I believe she was in New South Wales for most of her life. And she got taken over to England. And it's back in that episode, so go and have a listen to it. But essentially the story of Gwen is that during this regression, she had all this information come out. And one of the pieces of information that came through was that she sketched while in trance one of the slate tiles that she could recall from being in her home.
That's right.
And when they went over to England and they found what was now a barn, it previously had been a home, but it was now a barn.
So the dirt floor.
It was a dirt floor. They cleared away the dirt floor and they found this tile, this slate stone, that had been taken from the Glastonbury Abbey. It was a relic, and this impression that was in the stone matched what she had drawn while she was in trance. So it's pretty hard to fake that kind of stuff. And of course, there's a huge amount of controversy around past life regressions, because the big thing about it is this person concocting a story? Even though they may believe it, is it their imagination generating some kind of story?
Well, the skepticism can come in if it's for a TV show as well. If you've flown across the world for a TV show, there's, I guess, pressure to perform.
Absolutely, there
is. Come up with something.
Yeah, and we'll get into that, because in the three other women that were involved in this same series of research, essentially, that was conducted by Peter Ramster, is that there's one woman that stands out that she has conflicting information. It's like she remembers some things and then she has other details that come through, but then it's conflicting. But I'll get into that. But let's just start off on the simplicity.
When's the show from, by the way?
This is 1981.
Yeah, it's funny how I'm way more likely to trust the information from a show from 1981.
Absolutely.
Than anything made in the last 10 years.
No, I totally, in fact, I would say even the last 20 years, because, you know, most of those Ghostbusters shows, we know that a lot of it is faked. A lot of it is done for hype because the producers in the background are like, you've got to get this, you've got to get that, you know, you've got to have the attention going. And the reality is that when you get down to these hardcore cases, a lot of the times there's a huge amount of boring work that goes into the background before you get any kind of results. And that's exactly what happened with the case of Gwen. I mean, Gwen, I think she had dozens, if not hundreds of regressions that were recorded and carefully, you know, analyzed, and they had researchers look into the details in the background, you know, to produce this hour and a half long documentary.
And is it a BBC documentary?
No, it's Australian.
ABC?
I don't know if it's ABC, but I mean, 1981, so who knows how.
Probably.
Yeah, I mean, ABC, Channel 7, who knows back then. But
I'm saying if it's government funded, they would have their money and they're like, oh, whatever. There's not really the competition.
Absolutely. Yeah.
That you would have today where it's like, okay, now you need to act really scared.
Yeah.
And then we're going to get footage of you running through the forest and then you come up with something that you say you saw.
Yeah.
But that didn't happen.
Yeah.
But that doesn't matter. Just...
Yeah, oh, it doesn't matter.
That's
it's
the modern
purpose of entertainment.
That's the modern show.
Yeah, it is, unfortunately. I mean, you and I have experienced that to a degree as well. It's just, you know, when we've been invited to come on certain shows and do things, and it's like, I'm not going to lie. I'm not going to sit there and make out and pretend like I'm shocked, or because you can't fake that kind of stuff. People can tell. So, with this particular documentary, it actually then ties into some other experiences that I want to, you know, talk about. But really, let's start off with the simple kind of things, and then we'll head into the more in-depth kind of stories a little bit later on. So the three other women that were involved in this particular case, you've got Jenny Green, who was a migrant from England who moved to Australia. You've got Helen Pickering and Cynthia Henderson. Now, Cynthia Henderson, her case is particularly interesting. And I've taken some audio from this documentary so we can just hear the impact of what's going on and the memories that are coming through. And essentially with Cynthia and all these women, these four women that were involved in this particular investigation, they all had spontaneous recall of memories, what appeared to be not their own. Like, they are their own because they're past lives, but they're not from present time. Now, some of the arguments that's been made is, well, this is cryptomnesia of some kind. And cryptomnesia in a very simple form is that it's the idea that throughout our lives, we collect so much more information than we ever realize, huge amounts of information. And we read things and we see things on television and we hear things, and it's all stored in our brain, but we never consciously acknowledge it. And then for some reason, when you go into trance, you go into a regression, you put that information together and that information comes forward. Look, that might be an answer for some regression experiences that people have. But in this particular case, the reason why these four stories and some of the other stories I'm going to tell you today really stand out is because they have very, very specific details, precise details about names, places, events that took place, more than you'd expect just simply from cryptomnesia, that somehow your brain is that advanced that you're being pressured and suggested by the hypnotherapist to cough up information.
Well, it's the verifications we're really interested in.
That's right. Yeah, that's exactly right. So essentially what happened with Cynthia Henderson is that she started having recall of a life in France. Her name was Emily de Jouvet, and this memory just kept on coming through, and it was quite forceful in the regressions. Now, it wasn't a singular regression. There's a multitude of regressions. But as they started pulling out details, the reason why she came to the forefront is because those details were quite intricate. You know, just names and names of her husband and where she had been and places that she really enjoyed. And so this got the attention of Peter Ramster and the other researchers. And they came up with this idea to give each subject in this study a post-hypnotic suggestion that they would recognize the location of their previous life when they went there. But what he did is he took them overseas and he took them into Europe and he took them into Britain and he blindfolded them when he took them to certain towns where they claimed they had been from. And that's exactly what happened with Cynthia. You know, when she was taken, she was blindfolded and she was taken out of the car and shown what was supposed to be a site that she should have recognized from, you know, all this time back in the past. And I believe in this case, we're talking about the 17th century, 18th century. And she didn't know this particular location, but we find out that it's because the landscape changes so significantly over such a period of time. And of course, there's been wars, and that's the case in many of these stories, is that war changes things so dramatically as well. Like, places are firebombed. In the story of what I'm going to be talking about with Jenny, two-thirds of Dusseldorf was completely razed to the ground.
It's a funny premise when you think about it, though, because these women have had hypnotic regressions, I presume, where these memories have come forth.
That's correct, yes.
Right, so then they're having these memories in altered states of consciousness, but then you put them on a plane, you fly them across the world and you take them to somewhere else and you just get them to walk around.
That's right.
It's completely different.
It is, absolutely. It's almost...
What makes them think they're going to have any kind of connection to the place or remember anything?
Well, that's a really good point. And that was the post-hypnotic suggestion that was put in by Peter Ramster for them to be able to recall it consciously when they go to these locations. But it's strange. I'm glad you asked that question because it seems like, and in a way though, it just seems natural. It feels right that when these people go to these particular locations, yes, they're primed, right? I get it. They're primed to be in this location, but all of a sudden they're just reinvigorated and all the memories come rushing back like a flood. And all of us have experienced this. I mean, some people that have described this, particularly in these cases, it's like a flood of deja vu, like that eerie feeling of deja vu.
I remember when we had our hypnosis sessions and I couldn't really go under, but it did have like exactly what you're describing, this rush of memories and sensations of this. One of the first houses I lived in as a small child when my family first came to Australia from England.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd totally forgotten about that place and the size of everything in the bedroom and the way the furniture was rearranged. Like
Your it precision.
Just came rushing back. So it's like the memory, all the details that were required were there in the memory, but there's just something that is needed to unlock it.
That's correct. Yes. And it's almost like we're not accessing something within our memory. We're accessing something somewhere else.
Not the brain.
Yeah. It's like a non-local consciousness, but it's a constant stream of consciousness and that you're cut off from. It's like you're given segments. So each and every life is a segment. And the reason why you don't get granted access to that is, in fact, I was looking at some research by Barbara Hebert. And Barbara Hebert was presenting at a Theosophical Society meeting. And she was saying in her experience with people that have these past life memories, well, the reason why we don't access our past life memories is because if you believe that each and every lifetime is like a spiritual upgrade in a way, I mean, not upgrade, but the whole idea, it's a test and you're supposed to be able to kind of level up each lifetime. If you have memories of your previous lifetime, it will actually encroach on what's going on now and inhibit your ability to grow while you're here now. And I think that makes sense because there are negative attributes that come through from some people that have past life memories. You know, a lot of people experienced terrible nightmares, like these nightmares that they just can't get rid of, but they don't know why, and they will persist throughout their lives. Jenny Cockle is one good example of that, who will describe her story a little bit later on. And then, of course, you have people that have phobias, you know, terrible, horrible phobias, and you don't know why, like why you have that certain phobia. And it's similar to this mechanism, whatever it is, of people that tap into this stream of consciousness. And this is where people like Dr. Brian Weiss is a good example. He utilizes regression hypnotherapy, and we've covered his books in the past, to help people alleviate these phobias that they may have, these irrational fears, because they come through from past lives. They come through from past life experiences that are encroaching. But fascinatingly enough, with each and every past life researcher that I've been looking into over the past couple of days, they all say something very similar. The access to those past life memories usually only comes through when they had a traumatic or sudden death.
Yeah, right.
It's like there's no closure that takes place. And so that allows some seeping of that segment from one stream of the consciousness into the next segment, which then can cause these issues to take place. Now, Barbara Hebert describes this actually really great case, which is not necessarily a past life memory, but it does fit in with the greater field of how potentially a past life memory can affect you. And she describes the case of Kevin. And Kevin was this 4-year-old boy, and she wasn't treating him because of any past life phobias or anything like that. His parents had brought him to Barbara because he was suffering from what appeared to be some type of attachment disorder. And what attachment disorders are is that you can have, I think it's called avoidant attachment, where your parents never touch you, which is what they thought that this poor boy Kevin was experiencing. You can have obsessive attachment, where you have an overbearing parent. And all these issues can create problems for you later on down the line. And that's exactly what was happening to Kevin. So poor little Kevin, when he was born with a hole in his heart, and his parents weren't allowed to touch him because apparently if he was touched, it would cause his heart rate to go up and it potentially could cause great problems for him. So until they had that solved, which they did, he was going to have problems. And he was fine for a while until he reached 4 years old. And when he reached 4 years old, he had extreme anger problems, like completely unknown of for a four-year-old to experience. I mean, yes, four-year-olds have meltdowns, tantrums, those sorts of things. But these anger outbursts were horrible. So Barbara, not thinking about past life things, you know, got the child in and just started playing with him, and you know, in a therapeutic kind of way, just to see how, you know, she could work out what his issues were, thinking it was an attachment problem because he wasn't touched as a little baby. And he's like, oh, I want to play Batman. She's like, oh, okay, of course you can play Batman. And he climbed up on the coffee table in her therapy suite and he held his arms out and he jumped off. But when he jumped off, or just before he jumped off the coffee table, he says, my wings are leaking oil and I have to jump into the water. And she says, oh. And she thought, because it was Batman, okay, that's didn't think anything too much of it.
We've got another World War II pilot on our hands.
Well, you're right. You're absolutely right. Because he jumps off and she had to play this role with him where he was guiding her. But she had to scoop him up as the bird, he said, and take him to a hospital, which was a lounge, and bind him so that the oil would stop leaking out of his wings. And then as the sessions continued, he started to talk about things like, and this is a four-year-old, right? My four-year-old would not know what the term hydraulics is, but he was saying, my hydraulics have fallen into the ocean.
Wow.
And she's like, okay. The next thing he was saying, oh, and she doesn't describe it because
it was like, those damn Japs.
Well, maybe. She doesn't get the information because he says a name, like he says a place, and he says, my plane is going down. And he says a place near such and such. But yep. She said, I can't get that information out of him. And she says, okay, well, what's happening next? And he's not even in trance. This is just a four-year-old child recalling these memories consciously. He says, I can't get out. I can't get out. I'm really scared that I died. And then he's calm. And she's just looking at him. And he's just very matter-of-factly, like a four-year-old would say, he says to her, that's why I'm so angry. And it was like, because he was trapped in this past life, in this cockpit of the plane and can't get out, because it was a sudden and traumatic death, for whatever reason, that seemingly has bled over into this lifetime, maybe coupled, because you've got to remember, it's a very rich tapestry. It's not just one singular thing that can cause it, but perhaps because he had a hole in his heart, was that hole in his heart linked to him having something like a bullet go through his heart? We know with Ian Stevenson, some of the research that he's done, he's found that a wound from a previous life will correspond to a medical issue or a bruise or a birthmark in the next life.
You wouldn't think he would remember going down, getting stuck in there if he got a bullet in the heart.
No, that's true. But at least, you know, and look, she said, I wasn't able to verify any of these details. You know, this is why it was kind of a nothing throwaway case. But it wasn't nothing, because from that information, she said, well, look, you don't have to worry about that. That was another time. This is a new time. And would it help you if your parents reassure you that you're okay and it's not that same, you know, situation anymore? And he said, oh, I think it would. And almost immediately, he recovered from these anger issues that he was suffering from.
Yeah.
You know, and this is what Brian Weiss had looked into, you know, people suffering from phobia, people suffering from issues. It's almost like having the regression and tapping into the past life experience and just acknowledging it is enough to allow a rapid healing to take place so people can move on in their current life. But what is different? I mean, as I said, that was an outlying case. What is different about what was done by Peter Ramster is that these women just had spontaneously had these recollections, you know, coming through. So going back to the story of Cynthia Henderson, she was actually taken over to France. She was taken into Normandy, just outside of Fleur, and there was two locations she was taken to. But what was really funny at first, and I love it because it's the 80s, right? Obviously, the world was a different place back then. But because when she was in trance, this woman couldn't speak French. It was checked by Peter Ramster. She could not speak French. But for whatever reason, when she was in trance, in some circumstances, she could speak fluent French. And it wasn't just that she had gone and heard something and was repeating the phrases, right? It was also that they had a French regressionist in there who was asking questions in French while she was in a trance, and she was responding in both French and English.
Hmm.
So the thing is that, yeah, she could have, you know, known a little bit of French, but think about it. If you don't know a language and you sit there and someone suddenly starts asking you questions in that language, you may be able to guess a little bit, but the reality is you won't be able to keep that, you know, charade going for a long time. But she could. But they decided that they would do a physical test. So they take her to France and they take her to the markets and they run a little test.
Her story told of two places, a chateau near Fleurs in Normandy, where she said she'd lived, and another which she used to visit at Servan, about 75 kilometers away. And this, she said, was a manor house with a large coach gate in a U-shaped courtyard and near a chapel with a strange tower. First, though, a simple test to see whether she spoke or understood French without the aid of hypnosis. Few women can resist the sort of bargain Cynthia was being offered, but smiling and not understanding, she rejected the chance.
So what happened?
Few women can reject a two-for-one deal, so we said it in French to see if she could take it. And she did it, so she can't speak French. I was like, okay, that's like maybe a little bit of a ridiculous
test. I don't get what happened from the audio there. What happened?
So the test was, right, they wanted to see if she could speak French. So they took her to a market and they set it up. They got the stall owner to offer her an irresistible deal,
yeah,
but in French. And the idea was few women could resist such a great deal. And had she been faking it and been able to speak French, she would have jumped at the deal. So it's very presumptuous about
it. Maybe she was saying, no, I don't understand. It's but not very...
quite sexist.
Not very scientific, you think this test.
No, look, it wasn't very scientific, but you know, it was all part of, I mean, again, they're still doing a television show or a documentary, so I guess they are going to throw those sorts of factors in there. But on the opposite side of the coin, you have it, they brought in this devout Catholic and skeptic by the name of Antoine Le Breton. And Antoine Le Breton started doing a whole heap of research trying to find out details and names and places of what she had recorded in the regression. And I should point out, it's very important that when these three women we're going to be describing today go to these sites and they're recalling this information, they're saying these things, all of this has been pre-recorded.
Mm.
So it's not like they're going along and they're being prompted by Peter and other people. It's already been recorded and they're just trying to match it up. It's not like they're just going along with, you know, whatever's the, I guess, the narrative that's being created. So Antoine Le Breton, funnily enough, said, oh, okay, well, what was the name of your husband? And this was a Jean-Pierre Victoire Sinclair and two children, Marianne and Pierre. And of course, he looked at the local records and going back, you know, hundreds of years. And he was quite happy with it because he could find no records. He just said, oh, there's no records of this at all. But that doesn't necessarily mean that she's not telling the truth or that the information is incorrect, because as she was taken into this town and initially blindfolded, once the blindfold was removed, she seemed to work out where she was. And she started providing more and more concise directions to where her old home was. And she did. She provided these incredible details, but guess what she was following? She knew waterways. Something that I was saying with Gwen MacDonald, because so much time has passed, but things that don't normally change significantly are watercourses.
Yeah, and it would be a prominent feature in the landscape.
Absolutely it was. So she was able to follow these things all the way through, and she got to this basically little, she saw this wall, and she's like, oh, that wall is the wall to the chateau. And they drive up and they find that it's now actually a tourist destination and you have to pay to get in. But she knew exactly where the road would turn off. She knew exactly where the gate would be. And in her time, it would have been a carriage that had gone through there. So they drive through and it's almost like when you get close enough to where the memory, the strongest memory is, you are overwhelmed with that feeling.
Mm-hmm.
Because with each woman in this particular documentary, they are overwhelmed with this emotion. This overwhelming feeling comes through, and it's almost like the body can't process it because it's a collision of what I was referring to with those segments. So, I mean, there's a whole heap of really intricate detail, which I won't include in this section because I'll link to the actual documentary so you can see it for yourself, because otherwise we're just going to get bogged down in all the details. But suffice it to say, what happens is that she goes to a second site, and this second site is what she says is a chateau. And she kind of throws out these details of it being like, oh, well, there was a church there, and the church had these particular details like these wooden pews and these blue slate tiles and things that apparently shouldn't be for a French church of this vintage.
Right.
And yet when they get there, they meet this priest, and this priest has a history of the entire place. Even the font, like where the water is stored, the holy water is stored, normally should be in the middle, but she's like, no, it's to the left. All of that information is correct. Like, she has all of those details, which she had previously said well before she'd been at that location. So unless she'd done some type of very detailed research and had pulled a scam, where is she getting this information from? It's coming through somehow. Is it psychic, or is it that she really is having a past life memory of a place that she had lived? So I want to move on now to the story of Helen Pickering. And Helen Pickering is similar. Helen Pickering has this recall while under trance of being this Scottish doctor. The doctor was Dr. James Archibald Burns, and she includes, you know, these, you know, relatively mundane details like, oh, well, my middle name was Archibald, but I hated it because it was my father's name and I hated my father. You know, details that if you're pulling up or making up a story, it seems like it's not something you would do. Like, unless you're trying to deliberately deceive by making it, you know, mundane, it just doesn't make sense. So these details come through, and she recalls a life living in the south of Scotland in the mid to early 1830s. And of course, you know, Peter Ramster and his associates take her over to Scotland and take her to where she'd previously been. And she seems to be able to recall details of this city where she had been, of this, the pub that had been there, and details of like the waterways and, you know, really fresh memories that come rushing back when she's there. But of course, they're not all perfect. And it's funny how it seems like when they're taken to two sites, the first site, they're kind of very apprehensive about recalling details, or they don't recall the exact details. It's almost like the first site kind of primes them, opens up their psyche. And then when they're taken to a second site, that's when they're capable of pulling out even greater details. And that's exactly what happens to Helen Pickering, because Helen is taken to this second site in Aberdeen, which she recalls in one of her memories being the location where the College of Medicine was back in the day, back in the 1830s, or even earlier, I'm sorry, where she had been a student of medicine. And what's quite stunning about that particular case is that, like many of these regressions, you know, there's all this information that's kind of thrown in, but she wanders and she finds this building which is completely changed. It's completely different. She's like, oh, well, on the there used to be a third floor here, and there used to be this, you know, used to be the dormitories for the young students, but they're no longer there. Like, all these details, you can go, oh yeah, look, she could have pulled that information from anywhere. What really stands out with Helen Pickering is that there's a man that's actually as part of like the custodians of the building. His name's David Gordon, and he has these intricate plans that are only held with in this particular library. And the library is now a museum, but no one else has access to it in the outside world. And these plans haven't been shown to her to essentially set the scene that when she wanders inside, she's like, there's this staircase. There used to be a staircase right here. And she's really insistent upon it. And she's talking about this memory being so vivid. And people around her are like, no, there's no staircase. Like, it's obviously not here. You've got the memory wrong.
There's a second floor, right, though?
Yeah, there's a second
floor. So is there a staircase somewhere else?
There's a staircase at the other end of the building, right? But they go and they have a look at the plans that were held by David. And they find that, yes, indeed, decades ago, there was a stone staircase in that precise location that had been moved during one of the renovations. So for her to be able to pull that information through is very compelling, because it's very difficult to suggest that she had found out that information through any other means other than what came through and possibly this psychic connection to a past life. But one of the cases that really stands out and leaves you with that, well, is this real or isn't this, is the story of Jenny Green. And Jenny Green has this memory. It's a very traumatic memory that she has. She recalls being this teenage girl in Dusseldorf in Germany during the Second World War. And the audio I want to play for you now is of the actual regression. And you can just hear how traumatizing it is, because essentially she recalls being taken to what was known as Jew Town. Like, this was the term that was used for it. And she, in this regression, recalls going to a place known as Alstadt or something like that. It's coming through. And we find out that essentially she had been taken away from her home, and because she was young and fit enough to work, she'd been taken to this Jew town. And her role, her job, was to keep washing all these clothes that were coming through. And she kept on being told, you know, clearly by the Nazis that, oh, your job is to wash these clothes because it's people that are relocating, which doesn't make any sense. She's like, why are we doing this? But she didn't ask the question. But in the audio that I'm going to play for you, it's just very clear about how the traumatic experiences can still bring about a trauma today, because she talks about her friend Frida, who did ask their captors what was going on.
My friend Frida, she just asked why the clothes kept coming. They beat him. He made us all watch while they beat her and kicked her. He said we were to ask questions. We were just to walk would not let us help her. She just died. She just died in the dirt and they wouldn't let us help
her. You're coming away from that.
The depth of Jenna's emotion was all too apparent. In what she was saying, there was all the horror of the Holocaust. And we were all affected by it.
Now, I haven't put that Hitler sound effect underneath it.
What was that?
That was part of the documentary, so it was a bit cringe for them to put that in. But look, it was the 80s, so we'll forgive them for it. But you can hear the trauma that's coming through, and she's so emotive about this that it suggests that there is some type of realness to this. But where you can go, well, look, you know, could it just be the brain because it was such a traumatic thing to even describe that, of course, you would have this kind of reaction. Where it becomes even more fascinating is that they take it to another time and try to ask her to describe, you know, where this particular town was. Because I believe by this point, they weren't entirely sure what was going on. They knew it was kind of Dusseldorf, but they weren't sure. So they pull out a map, right? She's nearsighted. Like, she's quite nearsighted and she wears her glasses. Now, her glasses are taken off during the regression. She's told, while under trance, to come out and they hold up a map, basically, you know, that's a meter, like 3 feet away from her. She wouldn't be able to read it. It's this small map. And they said to her, show us on the map where you are. And she does so, right? She points to the map. She's like, here, and she provides details of the street. And then she falls back down into the trance. And when she comes out of it, they bring the map back and they say, can you point to where you were? She's like, I need to get my glasses. I can't see it.
Oh, wow.
So her vision...
her vision changes as well.
Changes in consistency. That's incredible.
That's cool.
To be that kind of, you know, physiological effect that's taking place. So, of course, they travel out to Dusseldorf and they go to this town and she wanders into this street and she has, like the other women, these flood of emotion because she seems to find the street that was her town or that was her home and where the shop had been of her father. But of course, they can't find any details of the names. They find this particular house and this woman that was in her 80s who had lived next door. And she has no recollection of this girl who would have been 10 at the time, maybe a little bit older, and she can't recall it. And it's all just very, it's kind of a letdown, right? I mean, she's shown these incredible things, you know, with her vision, for one example. But when they get there, they can't match it up. So Peter Ramster says, oh, let's go and have a look at a pre-war map. And they go and have a look at this pre-war map. And they find that it seems like, because she's saying, oh, there's a park and there's a hospital. And I remember them quite vividly. But where she was, it wasn't there, right? But there is a park and a hospital that's down the road, like quite far down the road. So perhaps, or there was at one point, it's not now, but there was during the pre-war. So maybe that's what had happened. Like maybe she'd gotten it incorrect. And of course, you're pulling information from one lifetime to the next. You're going to get things wrong. So maybe that's what's occurring. But they take her down there anyway because they don't want to lead her. But they think, oh, well, we'll take her to this site. And one thing that Jenny's been describing in intricate detail throughout many regressions is this incredible door of the hospital. It's like, you know, the olden style architecture that used to be done of this beautiful stone lintel that was carved beautifully and very, very large and opulent. And she's like, this is incredible. And it's blazoned upon her past life memory. And she keeps on describing it, but they go to this hospital. Well, take a listen to the audio because she gets taken to the main entrance of this hospital, which is on this corner. And she's like, no, that's not the entrance. And then she spies something.
This time we led Jenny to the place where that 1937 map showed there had been a hospital. And there was still hesitation, still some doubt. The big door with the decorated stone lintel didn't seem to be there.
The door wasn't on a corner like that. It was on a... There it is. Was that a door?
Could have been.
The stone was all these blocks. And the door, we had a big, heavy top part to it, and it had the flute bits all down the side.
Right. You're not too far wrong. There have been some changes. Let's see if you can get anything out of that.
Oh, yes, there. There's the door. That's the main entrance.
Okay.
I didn't believe it was there. I thought it was all wrong.
Not knowing the changes the years had brought, she had described the doorway exactly. A door which had been made a window years ago.
How long ago?
Decades ago. Decades ago. So how could she have known that? You know, it's not like there's just random photographs lying around in Australia in the 80s of this Dusseldorf hospital. And yet she was able to recall out these intricate details, which in a way, while they weren't able to confirm other information, they were able to validate that. How did she know? And this is where it kind of leaves you with the ambiguity of past lives, that no matter how much detailed information you pull through, in all of these cases, yes, some people have, you know, details that can be verified. Other details simply can't.
Yeah, I've been to Germany and I remember a bunch of things from that trip. And if you ask me details about it, I would get so much wrong. And that's in this lifetime.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's exactly. And that applies to just, you know, any situation when you think about it. You know, if you were able to, if you went to a location and you tried to pull out details, you would probably get it wrong.
Ask me about somewhere I went last week. Yeah. I'll give you the wrong details.
And yet for some reason for these people, these particular details just stand out so astonishingly that it seems to validate that there is something to past lives, that there is something to the continuity of the soul of the consciousness between each life. And why we have to go through that, well, who knows? I mean, but of course, you know, we know that the Hindus have described reincarnation going back, you know, at least 1,000 years in records. There's, you know, arguments, there's controversial, you know, ideas that the idea of reincarnation was removed from the Christian Bible around the 300s or around the 500s, somewhere in that range. So there is this persistent belief in reincarnation that exists, which suggests that, well, in combination with these stories, there might be something that's occurring. But one of the things that comes up with past life researchers, and a lot of it is pretty cringe in some circumstances, but there's this element of the idea of soul groups. And I guess from the idea is that...
Why are you making that face?
Because...
Soul groups are great. We're in one.
Oh, I know.
Obviously.
Well, what I'm...
Stuck with each other. Every fucking incarnation.
That's, yeah, that's like some type of karmic debt. It would make sense, right? If there's the idea of karmic debt, you are going to go through lifetimes with each people because you have these karmic bonds where you've got to kind of, you know, clear the karma. But unfortunately, until you learn just to let go, you're always going to be dragged through each lifetime with these groups. But the term soul group, in some circles, it's all very airy-fairy and kind of like, oh, you go through with the same people and it's what? No, yeah, well, it's not
airy-fairy about it.
It's not, though.
It's a technical term.
No, it's more than that. Like, there is this certain level of, like, the soul groups being like, it's all positive, it's all love and light, it's all... It's like, no, there's a reason for going through, you know, certain experiences with the same people because it's to do with trauma. And it's...
Well, most of the time it's due to karmic
debt.
That's
the thing. Yeah, it's karmic,
like,
debt.
Yeah, we were jerks to each other and you're paying it off in different ways.
And you're totally right. And where that comes through abundantly is the story of Millsboro. And Millsboro is just this incredible story. I'll link to a couple of documentaries that are out there online. There was also a book that was published that was called Mission to Millsboro. And this was...
Is this the Californian one I sent you?
Yes, it is. Yes, well, it's not California. It's over in Virginia. Well, it starts in California.
Okay.
But it regresses to over into Virginia. And this is the story that was put together, pieced together by a hypnotic researcher by the name, or a hypnotic practitioner, I suppose, by the name of Marge Ryder. And Marge Ryder is a really fascinating woman because she has people coming to her for regressions, you know, dealing with trauma, dealing with anxiety. And one of these people is Maureen Williamson. Maureen Williamson seeks her out because she had this traumatic event take place in her childhood, and it was causing all these problems for her throughout her life. And so I think she'd sought out counseling and, you know, a whole range of different services when she was referred to Marge. And she goes to Marge, and Marge had, you know, when she published this book, she'd appeared on Larry King, Donahue, you know, all those shows back in the time. But it was because Maureen seemed to be this linchpin, this center point for a group reincarnation, a group past life series of stories that are all pieced together. And what Marge found is that Maureen had this hypnotic trance, and she was taken back, and she's not taken back into a past life. Like, she's just taken back to her childhood, and she does hit on where this particular event took place, and it's immaterial to anything that's going on. But it was about a week later where Maureen is like, oh, there's just something that's really bothering me, and this name keeps on coming up. This name, John Daniel Ashford. It's
coming up in dreams or coming up in the.
It's just
regression?
At the forefront of her mind. John Daniel Ashford. It's a week later, and this name is just coming up, and she's kind of disturbed by it. So she calls Marge back, and she's like, "What's with this name? Like, what's this name coming through?" And Marge says, "Come back in, and we'll put you under regression, and we'll try and find out what it is." Now, Maureen Williamson, she's a newspaper reporter. She's a very down-to-earth kind of woman when she's plunged into this past life where she finds herself 135 years in the past, in this previous life, where her name is Becky. This is what's being pulled out from the regression. And she's living in this town of Millsboro, in Virginia. But what's fascinating about this is that, you know, Marge is trying to pull out as much information as she can. And she's like, oh, he's my husband. John Daniel Ashford is my husband.
Oh, I see.
And of course, Marge is like, well, I know that's not your husband because that's not your name. And then that's when they realize that this is 1861 in Millsboro. But she describes, it's like she mispronounces, it's like Millsboro or something like that. And Marge can't quite get the name. And she starts searching, like she's fascinated as she would be. She starts searching for this name and she can't find anything. And so she puts her back into a trance and she puts a pen into the right hand of Maureen, right? Maureen, in the trance, takes the pen from her right hand, puts it into her left.
She's a lefty in a previous life.
And she writes down the spelling of the town. And we find out later on that because she has the spelling, she's able to find the town in Virginia. It was a Civil War town or was involved in the Civil War in 1861. And she is able to find out that that's the pronunciation of that town back then. Like it used to be a different pronunciation back then. How would she know this? How would this, you know, unsuspecting woman from California that's a newspaper reporter be able to pull out those details? It's very unusual. So as this is progressing, more and more details starts coming through. And obviously, you know, Marge wants to dig deeper. And some of the criticism and skepticism that's put forward is that Marge is somehow coaxing this and somehow making it up. I don't believe that. She seems like quite a sincere person, and other people that are presenting, and I'll play some audio for you. You know, they say, no, I wasn't being prompted. This was just information that was coming into my mind and I was able to recall it. And so as they start digging deeper and deeper into Maureen's past, into this world of Becky back in the 1860s, she says, oh, this is Marge. You know, is there anyone else there? And as she comes out of one of these regressions, she says, oh, yeah, I saw Joe back there. And Marge says, who's Joe? Well, Joe is a retired police chief that Maureen...
She recognises someone from this life.
Yeah, he lives... He works down the road, right? He's just down the road. His name's Joe Nazikowski. And she's like, oh, Marge says to Maureen, you have to try and get him in for a regression, but don't tell him. Don't tell him anything.
Oh, so what does she do? She's like, oh, I know this really great person. Yeah. I know you've got a problem with your back.
No, with smoking.
Oh, smoking. Okay.
She's got a problem with smoking. And she's like, look, I know this woman. She's a hypnotist. She'll be able to help you with your smoking.
Right.
And so he does. He goes, right, sneaky, without knowing anything about the regression. He goes into regression, plunges into the past life, and finds out that he's Charlie Morgan. Now, there's some conflicting details about this, and I wasn't able, because the book was paperback, it is somewhere in our library, but there's about 140 boxes out there that I wasn't going to dig through.
Well, you're not allowed to open those boxes.
I'm not allowed to open those boxes until I could find somewhere to put the books. So I wasn't able to pull it, but what I pulled out of a few documentaries today is that either the name was Joe Morgan or Joe Patterson.
Okay.
And what we find out is that Joe is the original, the guy
today.
Yeah,
the policeman, yeah.
Charlie Morgan
or
Charlie Patterson. And Charlie Patterson, well, looking up some records, he actually was a cadet at West Point. And they have a photograph of the guy. So they were able to confirm that some of the details kind of did fit, but we're not entirely sure. But what we do know, and this is something that was, and I couldn't even include the audio. I'll include the actual show, the YouTube show, so you can watch it for yourself. But good old Donahue had the same reaction.
It was old Donahue.
Donahue. You know Donahue?
Yeah.
He's like, well, Maureen was a tramp. Like she was a fool because she was screwing Charlie Morgan.
She was a trollop.
She was a trollop, but this is all this intrigue that comes in, right? So Becky, she had an affinity for the South. Like she had a soft spot for the South. Her husband, John Daniel Ashford, well, he was for the North. And so what had happened was, is that it just so happens that Charlie Morgan was a spy for the South.
Intrigue.
He starts screwing Becky at this house, at this boarding house, right? So all these details separately, these two people separately are pulling up these details. So they want to bring in more. They want to bring in more people because...
Well, do they start recognizing other people?
They start recognizing other people in this life, but finding out details of them in the other life, right? This is a very intricate story to be able to maintain if it's a fakery.
And where are they today? They're not in Virginia,
no,
are they?
They're in California, right? So they're in this Californian town.
So it's the idea of, yeah, this group has all reincarnated at around the same time in around the same location.
Because there's a huge amount of karma involved here. And it seems like that's what's caused this. Because what we have is that later on, you've got Marge, who's sitting in a restaurant somewhere, right? And for whatever reason, she sees this guy, right? That's obviously just a local in the town. And she's like, oh my God, I recognize him. I recognize him. And she's looking. The guy's named Pat Green. He's a building worker. He has nothing to do with any of this. But she somehow maybe psychically recognizes him. Well, she recognizes him as being John Daniel Ashford, the North supporting husband of Becky, but in the modern times, right? So Marge jumps up and says, you have to come in for a regression. So I can see from a skeptical standpoint where that might be, you know, potentially that she's leading this guy.
Yeah, yeah.
And this guy was like, I don't want a part of it. Guess what? It takes 3 years for him to finally come in for a regression.
Three years.
They're like pestering him for 3 years. Until he's like, oh,
just
fine.
Wear him down.
I will come in for a regression. And he does. And I want to play for a clip for you. This is Pat Green himself.
What number is this?
This is number 6, please, Ben. Describing what had happened. And you know, was this a fantasy or was this actually a real thing?
But however reluctantly, Pat Green did feel something. And to his amazement, his story fitted the others.
I came up with something that really made me feel that there's more to this than I thought. Marge showed me an old photograph of Millboro, and I picked out this particular house. My feelings are that there is a hidden room underneath it, and in a smaller house on the same property, there's a trap door that leads to a tunnel.
It was information which would change Pat's mind. But was he too falling victim to a grand fantasy?
Hidden tunnels,
hidden tunnels,
doors.
And trap doors. So this is where there's also some conflicting information, but it seemed to provide something that can be validated. We can find out what's going on, and that's exactly what happens. Like these excursions to the past lives, Marge actually takes Pat Green and Maureen Williamson out to this town to see if they can recall things, and they do.
Well, but, surely there's not still the same
there.
Properties there.
Yeah.
I get that the town's still there, but not the same old house,
no,
surely.
The old house that Maureen lived in as Becky is gone. But what's incredible is that she goes over and she starts digging in the ground and they pull up a stump or a fence post, which confirms that there actually had been a home in that particular location at some point. They also have the saloon. And what Marge does is she takes them separately into the old saloon, which was also the boarding house. And Joe goes to one of the rooms. No, sorry, not Joe. Pat Green. Pat Green goes to one of the rooms, which he knew was his room. And without allowing Maureen to see, Marge takes Maureen up as well and says, show me where the room is. And she finds exactly the same room. So again, unless they've coordinated beforehand to say, well, that's the room we'll go into. But what was even more fascinating is that they find that room that he had, like this memory of a trap door. Well, it just so happens there was a house that burnt down. Mm. And when this house burnt down, they went into it and they found that in the ruins that there was this trap door that went down into this tunnel that was connected to a room. And he had described it having green concrete walls.
Yeah, yeah.
And there was green concrete walls.
Bizarre.
There was Civil War paraphernalia in there.
What was the tunnel for? For Civil War purposes, hiding ammunition.
Yeah, hiding ammunitions and that kind of. The other thing they found as well is that I think it was one of the participants that his role had been to, and this was the one of the spies, his role had been to, this is the guy, sorry, I just got my details here, Charlie Morgan. His role had been to, if for whatever reason the war turned against them, that he was going to sabotage one of the local tunnels, right? So with explosives, they go into this tunnel in the modern day and they find that there's these little holes in the wall where potentially explosives may have been placed.
Mm.
So for that information to come through is stunning, but this story comes together as Marge pieces it, everything, you know, she puts it together and finds out what had occurred. Well, it just so happens that John Daniel Ashford, you know, back in the time, who was with the North, had found out that Charlie Morgan was a spy. And he'd found out that he had been sleeping with a local girl. He didn't know who the local girl was. And he had sent an order to kill off the girl. Take a listen.
She worked out that John Daniel Ashford knew Charlie Morgan was working for the other side in the Civil War. His fears were then raised when he found out that Charlie was seeing a local woman.
He felt that the information might be going the other way, so he ordered her killed, not knowing that that particular lady was his wife.
Oh,
isn't that horrific?
Ruthless.
And do you see now why we've got these weird karmic threads that are going through, and why? And so the
that's going to take a few lifetimes to resolve.
If not thousands. So the next thing that we have is you've got Diana Lovegrand. Diana Lovegrand has
this is in the modern day.
This is in the modern day. She has these traumatic memories. Now, I don't know how she came to Marge. It feels like she just came to Marge because she was dealing with these traumatic dreams and memories that were quite overwhelming. And she couldn't work out what it was. Well, she gets put into a regression. Guess what she finds out? She finds out that she was the six-year-old daughter of Becky.
No way.
And even worse, and I'll link to this in the show notes. I won't play the audio for you. But even worse, these memories that she was having is she was witnessing the rape and murder of her mother.
Hmm.
So going back to Maureen. So this is the connection that she has to Maureen through being Becky, her mother, back in the past. You know, so you can,
see, it's interesting to think that that was what happened in the past life. What's their relationships like today?
Yeah, you that's know, a good
do they
question.
Just know each other? Or are they just acquaintances?
Well, it just so happens that I believe that Maureen ends up marrying another participant, but she finds, and this is why Donahue called her a tramp, is because she was sleeping with another guy around this time in this previous life, and she hooks up with him in a modern day, in the modern life. So, it's a quite a complex, incredibly detailed story, which I'll link to the book in the show notes.
But then you got to think the machinations in that previous life likely due to the karmic debts and relationships from the previous life to that one.
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
So, and you know, if she's builds. With all these different men, maybe they were husbands or she was even their husband in a previous life or a life before that.
Yep.
It's like a tangled web
that we're stuck in. And it becomes even more complex as you start going through. But this particular case just stands out as being one of the most compelling because of the details. Now, one of the issues is obviously Marge is the central hypnotist to this. So the argument has been put forward is that somehow she has been able to pull all these people in and get them all to tell this kind of story. But I just don't believe that. I think there's just like too much validation of details, which even Marge couldn't have known, like the trapdoor, like, you know, these ruins that they've gone into, that suggests that this information is coming from somewhere that is not of a means that we would expect. It's a supernatural means, whether that's past life or psychic or psychometry, I don't know what it is. It suggests certainly that something supernatural, something superhuman is taking place. So just briefly, before I get into some of the other, you know, kind of elements to this, I want to play you some audio of the story of Jenny Cockell. Now, Jenny Cockell actually published a book called Yesterday's Children, but it really highlights this whole concept of karma, right? And what role karma plays and how the emotions and feelings that you have in a previous life can significantly impact your modern life. Take a listen to what she has to describe with her experiences.
For as long as I can remember, I've had dreams of being Mary in Ireland and dying while the children were still young, not grown, in the 1930s. Terrible dreams of being alone in a room in pain, not at home, and knowing that there's nothing I could do to ensure the safety of the children's futures.
So this poor woman has these memories, these dreams, these feelings that are overwhelming her in the modern day, and she doesn't know where they're coming from. So she goes and she has a regression, and she finds that she's propelled back to this life where she recalls what happened from these dreams as well, of being feeling just horrible, like just dreadful, this despair that she's experiencing. But she's suffering from some kind of illness or something, but she's worried about her children. And she's got, we don't know exactly how many children she has, but it's 5 or 6 children. And it all goes to black. So clearly she passes away. But she's regressed to an earlier time and she's describing some of these wonderful memories that she has of her children. And I get it, you know, being a parent, it's like you want everything for your children. And she's like describing this scene where it's dinner time and, you know, she's having this wonderful meal with her children. And, you know, it's obviously a time where she's quite poor, but it doesn't matter. That's irrelevant. And then her husband comes home. And her husband is an alcoholic and a very violent thug, and it's awful, right? And that's why she's so obsessed with protecting her children. Now, sadly, when she passes away, That's why she's got this trauma that's left, right, which seems to travel through into her next life. But what can you do about it? Well, it just so happens that because these memories surfaced, because it came through and it caused her to go and, you know, get a regression, she's able to, on a map, while in trance, sketch out this particular location. She finds that it's this little town, north of Dublin.
What does she draw?
It's like just features of this particular location. And she's, and also,
like landscape,
it must be the landscape,
or
a map or something. I don't know how she gets it, but it comes through and it's this town called Malahide. So she goes to Malahide and she starts talking about this regression. It's funny how all these little things kind of fall into place. It all has to fall into place in a certain way because it's spoken about on local radio or on television, something like that. And it just so happens that she gets a letter from a guy living in Malahide, and he's an elderly gentleman. And he says, I know the story of a Mary Sutton who died, you know, many, many years ago in the 1930s or something like that. And she had, you know, six children. So, of course, the investigators, they go and they look into the story of Mary Sutton, and they find that Mary Sutton, yes, she had six children, and she had died, you know, prematurely. I think she was 32 or something like that. But the children, sadly, the children had been sent away, but the eldest son had been kept. So the eldest son was kept by the father just simply to maintain the house. And these five other children were sent to an orphanage and scattered across the world or scattered across the landscape. Well, because she has this regression, the information comes through, they're able to find all of the children and reunite them together. And they're all elderly now. Like they've all been living their own lives. But when they get together, they realize little details, like that a couple of them had been living down the road from each other for 40 years, like all, but none of them would have been able to find each other unless these details had come through. And they say they now have contentment and that the memories that their mother describes, as she's describing, are exactly what they recall as well.
So this is interesting. This is very different, obviously, from the California people that remembered being in Virginia.
Very different.
They're not interacting in this current life. So how are they supposed to resolve karmic debts between each other? Is it not meant to happen in this current life?
Well, I don't know, but it's almost like whatever the karmic debt is that the mother was so worried about her children that she had to make sure, like, it's almost like it couldn't rest until she got her children all back together and they were content, even in the next life. It's like this, and we're not to know what it is. Like, we don't know exactly what's going on, but we do find that there are these connections that come through. Another example of this, which really stands out, is the story of Peter Hume. And Peter Hume...
Why does that ring a bell?
Because Peter Hume believed that he was John Raphael. And John Raphael was a soldier during the English Civil War, and Peter Hume was able to recall these details and these memories. And typical of these regression stories, I won't bore you with it, but essentially he has details, names, locations that are validated, right? And you get a bunch of researchers that come in and he appears on the television circuit. But what really stands out, right, is another one of these reunion stories, because he appears on television and he gets a phone call. There's a phone call to the green room that he's sitting in. And the assistant of this television show says, your daughter's on the line. Now, Peter Hume thinks it's his modern day daughter. It's not. It's his daughter from his previous life. And what's incredible is that, yeah, it could just be some lunatic, but he's got details about memories that he's pulled out in a regression before of an interaction he had with his daughter that he hasn't publicized anywhere. No one knows about it. Well, Barbara Hartfield, who claims to be his daughter in a previous life, provides those details. Take a listen.
Now, at that particular time, I thought that he meant my real life daughter, Karen, who lives in near Loughborough. Well, I picked the phone up.
And I said, I'm really not a loony and I'm phoning from London and I was your daughter in a previous life.
Now, my first reaction was, this woman is stark raving mad.
Daddy, what
are you doing? I said to Barbara, do you remember on either your fifth or your sixth birthday on the farm? She said, yes. I said, can you remember what I made you? She said,
For my sixth birthday, he made a horse out of wood.
I said, that's correct. I said, what else?
And put green and yellow ribbons around it.
Oh, bizarre.
Isn't it bizarre? But it's incredible that these weird soul groups, people have no connection to each other whatsoever, But there are these underlying connections and these weird synchronicities that take place that she happened to see him on television at that time, and she was able to call him and recall that information. Now, you know, I did see an argument today saying, well, maybe Barbara is just naturally psychic and she doesn't realize, and she's somehow just connecting with him and tapping in. Maybe, you know, maybe. But again, is that any less astonishing, you know, as opposed to these stories of past lives? It's still incredible. So there's just so much here to unpack, and there's so many different stories. One of the last stories I want to leave you with before I play you an incredible encounter that details death as well, the entity of death that comes through. I want to play for you the audio of Matthew Held. Now, Matthew Held had this incredible experience when he was 7 years old. He was 7 years old and he was playing in his father's bedroom, and under the bed, his father had this suitcase full of World War II memorabilia. And he pulls it, and there's this old field telephone. Basically, it's like an intercom, you know, with a long cable on it. But you ring it up and you can play with it. So he asks his father, what's this? His father describes it, as I just did. And he says, can I play with it? And his father says, yes, of course. So his father takes one, you know, one of the receivers and goes into another room and rings him up and starts talking to his son, Martin. And Martin looks at the phone. He says, what's this button on the bottom? And he says, oh, it's a Morse code button, so you can send Morse code. And he says, oh, okay. He presses the Morse code button and is instantaneously, without a regression, flung back into a previous life.
Can you what?
Play audio 12 for me, please, Ben.
Within a fraction of a second of hearing the Morse code, the actual room itself changed completely. And then heard a low rumble and saw one of these old aircraft coming along in the sky, and it was being attacked by a smaller aircraft. In the next second, it exploded the larger aircraft. I just couldn't understand what was going on. I was rather frightened at the time.
And as you would be, he's 7 years old. He's terrified because everything seems realer than real, a phrase which is used so commonly in these sorts of experiences, near-death experiences, past life experiences. And his father dismisses him. His father's like, oh, you're being ridiculous. You're being silly. And he doesn't think too much else of it. Until he gets to about 17 years of age and he goes to join the Royal Air Force. He goes into the RAF. Now, when he goes into the RAF, he goes to a Morse code testing site. Like they wanted to see how competent he would be at Morse codes. So he goes and does this Morse code test and he gets asked to come back in. And they say to him, have you ever had any experience with Morse code before? And obviously not recalling the experience of so many years ago, he says, no, I haven't. And the recruiter says, well, we're quite shocked because you got 100%. We've never had that experience before.
Wow.
He knew Morse code. That skill, gosh. That memory had come through. So, of course.
What a useless skill to retain.
Yeah, I know.
Out of all the things you could remember, you remember Morse code.
Back then, it was still utilized. So, it wasn't a big deal. But he ends up going through more regressions, as many of these people do. And he pulls out the name Richard Seymour. And he does find this Richard Seymour. Richard Seymour was in the military, he was in the Air Force, and he was a Morse code operator on an aircraft that was shot down and lost. And in one of the regressions that he's going through, he describes being shot down and he says, my body will never be found because the explosion essentially wiped me out. And when they look into Richard Seymour, he is classified as missing and killed in action.
Oh, really?
But they never found his body. So is he, you know, is Martin Held the reincarnation of Richard Seymour? I mean, we'll never have any perfect, you know, proof that that's the case. But it seems to be that, yes, these people are recalling incredible details, but not just details, skills, exceptional skills from previous lifetimes. So the story that I want to leave you with, though, is about the in-between space. You know, what happens to people if there are past lives? And this is the idea, is that it's just this, you get reincarnated about 50 to 70 years after each life. And we know the, you know, the near-death experiences. And usually it's you find yourself in a dark, calm room. Sometimes there's soft music playing and there's a white tunnel. There's a light at the end of the tunnel, I'm sorry. And you head into that and you're embraced and you end up in a field and, you know, there's people there and, you know, all good, happy things. But sometimes it's a little bit dark and sometimes you have to fight back. So there's the story of Margot Cray. Margot Cray was in India in 1982, so relatively recently, and unfortunately she was struck down with typhoid. And typhoid is a terrible illness. And as she lay lying on a bed, it seems like she died because she had a near-death experience, but she didn't go into a dark room. She didn't see the tunnel. She found herself as a young girl, like herself, in a pool, like in an actual pool, like a swimming pool. But in the pool is something terrifying. Listen to how she describes it.
And I looked on the other side of the pool and I could see this dark, murky patch on the bottom of the pool. And I knew that it was a dead body without being told. And I didn't want to go over, but somehow I was compelled. It came up from the bottom and grabbed me in a vice-like grip and started dragging me down. And just as I felt I couldn't hold on any longer, I did actually, just my head came out of the water. And with my free arm, I said to it, "Oh, no, you don't." I said, "You have no power over me. I'm stronger than you are." And with that, it let go. And at that moment, I found myself back in my body and in my bed. But the extraordinary thing was, at that moment, the temperature broke. And after that, I started to make really quite a speedy recovery.
That's incredible.
Isn't it? I just love it, though. It's like this British stiff upper lip of, "Oh, you brute!
Oh, no, I will not be going!" Don't.
But isn't that fascinating that she not only, you know, found herself back in her bed, in her body, but the fever broke at that moment.
Yeah.
It's like she had overcome this death that was coming for
her. Internal struggle.
So look, there's obviously, this is just a very much a very short description of these, you know, incredible tales, but I'll link to the books and the documentaries and the clips in the show notes at mysteriousuniverse.org so you can dig into it in greater detail. I saw that there was a second book that Marge had actually published, which included greater details and more information that had come out after she published the first. So I'm going to pick up a copy of that and look into that, and we might have it come up in another show.
Thanks again to Nicole for sending us that link as well. Yeah, that was good stuff. Well, coming up in the Plus extension, we've got the follow-up, speaking of follow-ups, to The Yowie, released back in 2006 from Paul Cropper and Tony Healy. 300 documented reports, 300 reports piled on top of that for this new one.
And we're going to cover every single one.
Every single one that involves Bigfoot's ass, we are handpicked by Mysterious Universe.
Ass curated.
They're not even necessarily the most compelling reports.
No, it's just the theme and we're going to go with it.
Yeah,
it's just, we're committed to it and that's what we're going to do.
How we do our research on this show. That's coming up after the break. We're going to go into the Yowie file, some of the most bizarre encounters. There's some high strangeness as well from some of these Australian encounters. And if you think that the idea of Bigfoot is just kind of one thing. No, not silly, but one thing. It's just this large, unidentified ape. Then you're mistaken, because especially in the Yowie files in Australia, you've got at least 5 or 6 different species we're talking about.
Really?
And even the Aboriginals, depending on where they are in the country, have multiple descriptions of different types of entities. The Yowie is just one. There's all sorts of others, from little diminutive ones.
Oh, yes,
to
you are right.
Incredibly thin, bizarre-looking ones with black round eyes. There's some really weird stuff coming up. Head over to mysteriousuniverse.org/plus if you want to get access to the extensions we do every single week. Sign up today, you get access to the extra, you know, hour at least that we do on these extensions. And, of course, you get our exclusive Plus shows that come out on Tuesdays. Plus members, when you sign up, you also get a totally ad-free version of the show, and you get what else do you get? I just went blank. I just went completely blank. That's what happens when you do like a sales pitch 10,000 times. It's just meaningless.
You did higher audio quality. You did the shows on Tuesday.
I just went totally blank.
It's all there.
And of course, if you sign up for MU Max, our higher tier, you get access to the back catalog as well. So sign up today, mysteriousuniverse.org/plus. $9 a month. Help support your favorite show. That's a wrap for this free edition of the podcast. Thanks for listening. If you're on Plus, stick around for the great stuff after the break. For everyone else, we'll catch you next week. Welcome back to your Plus extension. Great to have you with us.